For this talk, I'm going to follow what's sometimes referred to as the military system of talks, in which you tell people what you're going to say, then you say it, and then you remind them what you said. So I hope that works. I'm also going to draw on the very nice talk by Guido Altarelli, where he gave an overview of electroweak physics as well as QCD. And I'm going to try to take what I think are the recent developments in this field, at least from my own perspective, and try to focus on those. It's always, I think, nice to hear about the newest things that are happening, particularly if you're not working in those areas. So I start out with an outline of recent results that will be discussed. So this is the summary, kind of. So first, a week ago today, in fact, the muon anomalous magnetic moment came back. So it seemed to have gone away for a couple of years to some extent. It was there being analyzed. And in particular, the mu minus data that was collected in 2001 was reported last week. So it's the new EA21 experiment. This was all the data that they had. Previously, they had reported the anomalous magnetic moment for the mu plus, and this is what it is, okay, with the error in brackets there. And the mu minus is almost as good. Here's what the statistical error is, and here's the systematic. They weren't added in quadrature, but you can see they're roughly the same. When we were hearing rumors about the result, it was very secret, but the only thing we were told is it wouldn't embarrass the laboratory. By that, we took it to mean that they didn't differ by 3 or 4 sigma from one another, which is what people thought would be the embarrassment. It's a blind analysis, so it's not rigged. And I think, somewhat unexpectedly, the mu minus is higher than the mu plus. I say unexpectedly because somehow, as a theorist, you think they're always going to be exactly the same, and the error is just going to get smaller. But these things do move around a bit. And they're consistent with one another. So if you believe in CPT, you should be able to average them. And then this is the new world average, where I've gone out to one more decimal place. You could quote 60 here if you like, but that's what the experiment advertises now. So in my opinion, they sort of had the maximally interesting result, in that the average went up, but they're consistent with mu minus and one mu plus. That's a very subjective view, because I want to see new physics in this. If somebody's interested in just confirming the standard model, well, it would have been sort of nice if the mu minus was a little bit below this and it moved down in its average towards the standard model. Now, the old CERN result from 3 experiments carried out in the 1970s was plus or minus 840 compared to the 58. Here, times 10 to the minus 11. The experiment was proposed with a goal to go to plus or minus 40, so they came pretty close. They didn't quite make their goal of 40, but they did a nice job, I think, in improving this. And so far, to my knowledge, there's been no real criticism of the experiment. And the experiment, like I said, has always been done with 5 different groups doing the analysis blind. Until they agree with one another, they don't open the box to find out what the offset is, so they don't know what the value will be. And so, since they only measure one number, they have to try to reassure you that it's really been done right. And you'd have to hear a whole seminar on it, but it's really a very elegant and, I believe, well carried out experiment. Now, in terms of the difference between theory and experiment, it's a little controversial because there are a number of different theory calculations that are out there. What they do is they compare against the most recent, in their opinion, believable published calculation, because they have the old-fashioned view that a referee going over things makes sure that it's right, and therefore it's to be trusted. And so Davier et al. From a 2003 update was used in the comparison, and I've taken their analysis from E plus E minus goes to Hadron's data, put into the dispersion relation. And if you do that, and I'll repeat this in a minute, you find that the difference between experiment and the standard model is about 270 plus or minus 100 when you add the theory and the experimental uncertainties in quadrature times 10 to the minus 11. So it's about a 2.7 sigma. Back in 2001, when we started playing this game, it was a 2.7 sigma, but it was a bigger deviation and the errors were bigger. So we're back there at about a 2.7. Now, there's more recent theory development since this Davier et al. Update. In particular, there's a very big paper by Hagiwara et al., which does an analysis of the E plus E minus data as well. And Jaegerlano, who's been a player in this for a long time, has updated his analysis of E plus E minus. And a very nice paper on light by light has come into the picture by Melnikov and Weinstein. So there are other issues here. And depending on how you want to treat these, how you want to include them, whether you think they're better than this, et cetera, you can find a deviation that ranges from as big as 3.4 sigma to probably as small as 2.2 sigma. But that's sort of the range depending on how you want to treat these, and I'll say more in a minute. Now, there are complications. One people know about is the tau data does not agree with the E plus E minus annihilation data. That's a complication. And if you just use the tau data where it exists and replace the E plus E minus data in those regions where the tau data exists, there's not enough tau data to do the whole analysis with tau. But if you do that, you find blindly a 1.5 sigma reduction, which certainly would bring things to a less interesting region, better agreement with the standard model, etc. So I'm going to talk about a little bit in a while about the status of that. Let me just say that the only people who have done this analysis in detail is Davier and his group, and his attitude now seems to be you can't believe the tau data. So he sort of seems ready to abandon that. Now, I'll say why. So he was the main advocate. I think I was the second most favored person for talking about this. I always liked the idea of using the tau data. I still think that in principle you can use the tau data in this kind of analysis. I don't believe you can use the tau data as it's been presented so far, because I don't believe that they've done the isospin corrections in total. And that's the trick. To go from charge current data to electromagnetic data, you have to do isospin corrections. And although they've made an effort to do a lot of those corrections, it appears that they've not been done completely. And it may be impossible to do them in a believable way completely, but that's under investigation. Now, the deviation here, if it's real, has very important SUSY implications, or it could be other new physics. There's something on the order of 500 papers that have been written since 2001 about implications of a deviation here. So there are lots of potential SUSY ideas floating around, as well as some others, although SUSY is certainly the favored candidate. I like to say you might think that everything that can be said about this has already been said, and it probably has, but not everybody said it yet. So we'll still see another 500 papers on the subject. The future for the experiment and theoretical developments, I'll talk a little bit about. On the theory side, we always hold out hope that the lattice is there, first principles calculation, and they're going to come to the rescue when all else fails in doing hadronic low energy physics. It may actually be true in this case. In fact, I've made myself a little unpopular at Brookhaven, where we have a strong lattice community, by saying if they can't do this calculation, they probably should retire because they can't do anything. This is probably the most straightforward lattice calculation to be done with high precision that's out there. So, now, the person most responsible for this effort unfortunately passed away in this last year, Vernon Hughes, who was sort of the father of muon physics. When the question was asked by Robbie, who ordered the muon, the answer at Yale was always Vernon Hughes, because his whole life was doing muon physics. He discovered muonium. He started this experiment. He pushed it through for 20 years, etc. So he'll be greatly missed. And it's unfortunate that he couldn't have seen this very interesting result. But whatever, even if he had, I said to people, he should have been allowed to see his last result. They said it wouldn't have been his last result. If he were still around, there'd be many more experiments coming up. So this is the storage ring, to give you a feel for it. This is before it was covered up. It's one continuous superconducting magnet, the biggest in the world, so that the magnetic field is very constant and stable throughout. That's important, because if you're going to measure something to better than one part per million, you have to understand the magnetic field to better than one part per million. And that's their systematic error. The main systematic error is the uncertainties there. And that uncertainty seems to get very, very small. And each time they run, it gets smaller because they improve the magnetic field throughout the ring. So they haven't come close yet to their systematic uncertainties in this experiment. Here's what it looks like covered up as a real working experiment. And this is the old mu plus data, not the stuff that they presented. I didn't have time to get a copy of that. But you can see the usual distinctive signature as you go as a function of time. These muons are precessing in the magnetic field in this kind of sinusoidal way, and they're decaying away. And so here's the, because of the muon lifetime. And then after a while, the beam kind of gets kind of raggedy in there, and then they expel the beam and they start over and do the whole process with another pulse. The mu minus data looks the same, as you might expect it, except it's actually of better quality down here. They've made improvements, so each time the experiment seems to work better. And for some reason, mu minuses were a bit more stable, partly because the running conditions changed. There was a little wobble in the ring. It's called the tune of the ring that causes that. And they ran at a different tune. So each time they do this, they learn something. And so each run is really a very different experiment than the one before it, which is important. Okay, another thing that happened recently, again, this is a personal perspective on what's interesting happening out there, is that the Slackey 158 experiment wrote a preprint reporting the result, now officially, that they talked about last spring, in fact. This is polarized electron-electron scattering, fixed target, the parity-violating asymmetry, a very difficult experiment, but another very elegant, well-carried-out experiment. Coincidentally, one of the spokesmen for this experiment is Emlyn Hughes, the son of Vernon Hughes, so the tradition goes on with electrons rather than muons this time. They were actually competitors in the deep and elastic business with electrons versus muons. They reported the first results from the first run of three runs that they had. The goal is to measure sine squared theta w in this asymmetry to about 0.0012. Initially, the goal was a little bit better than that. Probably the systematics are a little worse, although with time, they'll get the systematics down. And the statistics won't be quite what they had hoped for, but still a very successful experiment. There's a theory uncertainty because they measure the weak mixing angle essentially at zero momentum transfer, very close to q squared equals zero. And then you have to extrapolate up to the z pole if you want to compare against z pole measurements. That is what they did. And that extrapolation error is over here. The E plus E minus to hadrons data is also used in that extrapolation. And so if you improve it, this can go down. In fact, probably if you did the analysis today, this analysis was done some years ago, the error here would go down by about a factor of three or so. But no one's redone that analysis. But it's the same kind of E plus E minus goes to hadrons data, but not weighted at really low Q squared. This is more like the running of alpha, although the isospin is somewhat different. This is to be compared against the Z-pole measurements, the leptonic asymmetries that give a sine squared theta W of around 0.2308. So they're just a little under that, but certainly consistent. And the forward-backward asymmetry, which gives a bigger value. Now, the sensitivity of the determination of the Higgs mass from loop effects on the exact value of this, I think, is well illustrated here. If the leptons are right, the central value of the Higgs mass comes out to be around 54 GeV. If the BB bar is right, it comes out to be 540 GeV. So there's a huge difference here that somehow one has to get around. As Guido said, they usually cancel one another out because they're averaged together, and then we get something a little bit more reasonable. In addition, this shows something, an interesting feature of the determinations of the Higgs mass. Although I didn't put the uncertainties in over here, let's say they're about 100% or so. And then you see what happens is, because the Higgs mass comes in logarithmically, well, 100% error over here doesn't look so bad. It still says there's a light Higgs. 100% error here says it can be anything, the Higgs. Who knows what it is? So the fact that we're claiming the Higgs mass is light is totally due to the fact that its central value is coming out to be so low, and that the errors scale with the central value. And if it had turned out that the Higgs was favored to be heavy, we can't say anything really about the Higgs. It's an interesting feature. Anyway, this discrepancy is about 3.5 sigma. It's been around for a long time. E158 somewhat favors the leptonic. They're not going to get to a level where they're going to probably rule out one or the other. They negate the pull of Nutev, although it's not a big pull on the determination in the global fits. Nutev is up above this, they're somewhat below this, and so the two now tend to cancel with one another. Their uncertainties are probably about comparable, at least for things like the Higgs mass determination. Now, how will this be resolved? It's a very unfortunate feature of these precision measurements that what might be argued is the most important parameter in weak interaction physics, sine squared theta w, has this twofold ambiguity in what its value is, and we don't have any way to determine sine squared theta w accurately at our disposal anymore. There's the idea of going to giga z, which is a good one. In fact, we probably should have already been sitting at the z doing a giga z and doing b physics that way, but somehow we didn't have the wisdom to do that. We went and did b physics at low energies. That would be a great way to improve it. As the slack experiment in left-right asymmetry demonstrated, one could do maybe a factor of 10 better, and that should certainly be pursued if it's possible. Another possibility, and it's the reason I mentioned this one, is to do E minus fixed target at the linear collider. Okay, when you dump the electron beam, it's polarized, and if you don't destroy the polarization in that process, then you can redo this slack experiment. In fact, part of the reason people were enthusiastic about the slack measurement is it kept the work on polarization alive at slack, and in addition, it's viewed as a preliminary measurement to what might be the ultimate fixed target experiment at a linear collider, where you would go at higher energies and have higher intensities, and you could measure this almost as well as you could do it with a giga z. The only thing is you'll do it at low q squared, and so you'll have to know the z plus z minus theta better if you want to extrapolate to mz. It's not a fault of the experiment. They measure at low momentum. If somebody here wants to extrapolate down to zero, they've also got to face this difficulty. Okay, so now the W mask we don't mentioned also, because of slight changes in the LEP value, has come down. This is somewhat of a relief or an unfortunate situation, depending on your perspective. It allows a somewhat heavier Higgs. There is a danger that MW is ruling out the standard model. If from global fits, we expect MW to be around 80.39. So MW has been high for a while, suggesting a very light Higgs, maybe around 20 or so GeV is the central value. The errors were big enough so that, again, when you fold it into these global fits, most things get washed out to some extent. And this one, although it was playing an important role, it wasn't ruling out the standard model. It still suggested that it's light by this number. This number is still on the high side, but the Higgs mass rules probably moves up to around 50 GeV from this kind of a value, with still big enough errors that you can get away with this. It suggests, as this one did, that the top is heavier than we've been using for the last 10 years or so. And Guido made this point that 180 GeV top instead of 174.3 goes in the right direction of fixing up some of the problems in getting a low Higgs mass in both these determinations here, more in this determination that's coming from MW. Coincidental, D0 has been talking about a reanalysis that gives something like 180 for the top, and we heard that CDF has some preliminary work with RUN2 data suggesting perhaps a movement upward. So I don't know if you can call this a prediction of these loop corrections, but there's been a suggestion for some years that life would be a little easier in the standard model if the top were around 180. In fact, when we had this value, maybe 185 or so would have been preferred. Now 180 would work very nicely. Now the goal of the Fermilab program to get down to around 20 MeV is very nice, given this consideration, and getting the top uncertainty down will be a nice confrontation. And then at the linear collider, of course, we hope one can do much better on some of these things. Now, how to bring these types of measurements together with the anomalous magnetic moment? There is a connection, and the connection is this E plus E minus goes to hadrons data that enters into all of these kinds of comparisons, at least most of these kinds of comparisons. In the case of the anomalous magnetic moment here, it's the hadronic loop vacuum polarization that comes into play. And we get that currently from E plus E minus goes to hadrons data. In the M Higgs, what we do is we compare W mass or sine squared theta W against the fine structure constant, which is at zero momentum transfer. So we have to go from zero momentum transfer up to mz squared. And again, we have to know what this vacuum polarization is from hadrons between zero and mz squared. And we do that using E plus E minus goes into hadrons. And so, if you like, you can view the anomalous magnetic moment as telling you something about this data, whether the data you're using in these other processes is correct or not. Okay, so they have a strong connection. And in fact, the tau problem that I mentioned at the beginning is there for both of these. It's more obvious now for the muon anomalous magnetic that we had moment that we have this problem because we're trying to talk about a deviation, but it's there in the Higgs determination as well. And in fact, they're anti-correlated. It's not a very strong, because the anomalous magnetic moment is dominated by low Q squared, and the Higgs comes from all regions of Q squared, there's not a completely simple relationship between them. However, there is the anti-correlation in the fact that if you try to say this data is a little bit off for one reason or another, and if it's done correctly, it'll bring this thing up to the experimental value, the theory. The consequence of that is the Higgs mass prediction will go down, and it's already precariously low. And so that you can sort of force G minus 2 to agree with this data without doing something about this Higgs mass. Now, maybe it'll take care of itself when the data is sorted out, but they do have this rather interesting connection. I'll say something about that in a minute. Okay, finally, the thing I wanted to mention is we usually talk about MW and sine squared theta W separately because this has sort of been a leptonic E plus E minus type measurement, and this until the lep measurements was the domain of hadron colliders. But the two together are a very powerful constraint because they don't depend on isospin violating effects like the high top quark mass, or what's called sometimes the T parameter, etc. They just give you this isospin conserving effect S, or the epsilon 3 that Guido talked about, and they're also sensitive to things like excited W bosons. And in fact, there's a simple formula you can write down. It only requires input alpha and the Fermi constant, and then you can relate sine squared theta W to MW like this. And if you do it, you find even with the values we have today, but using this sine squared coming from the leptonic numbers at lep and slack, you get that the S parameter is minus 0.13, and even the global fits, it has this tendency to be a little bit negative. But with rather small uncertainties, where the uncertainties from MW and the sine squared are about the same, showing that they've been measured about as well in this. And so it's very hard to accommodate an S bigger than 0.2, unless there's some other new physics that's coming in besides just this S. Most of the new models, whether they're called the little Higgs model or some of the new composite models, et cetera, that bring back dynamical symmetry breaking, tend to give an S that's bigger than plus 0.2 or around 0.2. And this is a hard thing for them to live with. What they have to do is not only get an S of this value, but have other physics giving a T that cancels against it, and maybe some other physics that comes into play over here. So pursuing these measurements further is very important, particularly if you want to rule these things out, or if you believe in these things, seeing a non-zero effect, and maybe hoping that it turns out to be positive. Now, I'm not going to give any discussion, real discussion, of flavor physics, except for the muon G minus 2, although certainly neutrinos and muon physics and B physics are in the limelight right now. But I will say that if G minus 2 is indicative of new physics, then other chiral changing effects, like transition moments and electric dipole moments, should start to be seen in these other processes. And in fact, there's a new generation of experiments in this domain, and that should be a really interesting program if the G minus 2 is right. It'll be interesting also if it's not right, but it'll be more interesting if it's right because they'll find all sorts of deviations. So now that I've outlined it, let me talk about the specific topics. So the muon, now I can, the muon anomalous magnetic moment, here's the experimental number. This is the last result. All data has been analyzed. Additional running, which they would like to do, could bring this down to about 30 or 40. An upgraded experiment that has a higher acceptance for the muons could maybe do another factor of 10. That will be hard. The systematics will have to be looked at very carefully for that. People are talking about bringing the muon G minus 2 storage ring to Japan, what we sometimes call outsourcing here in the United States, and doing the experiment over there. Whether the theory could get to this level is a very tough issue. Something would have to be done, it seems to me. The lattice would have to be miraculously better than I can certainly imagine. So it looks like the theory could get about to this level, so there's maybe a good match. Here's the QED contribution. There's usually QED electroweak and hadronic effects. The coefficients of the alpha over pi cubed are big because of electron loops and light-by-light scattering. This coefficient's undergoing a little modification. Kinoshita has been modifying it for a couple of years now, and it will become a little bit bigger. I didn't want to give a value because he hasn't published his result yet. But the uncertainty is probably small enough that it won't cause any significant effect. The electroweak has this classic W and Z diagram. The Higgs is negligible in all of this. It was calculated in 1972 by a lot of esteemed people like Weinberg and Jakif, etc. And they all got this very nice finite result. They showed that it was finite. And the original goal of EA21 was to see this effect at the 5 sigma level. That's why they aimed for plus or minus 40 times 10 to the minus 11. At the time, people said, well, you know it's there, right? So what do you have to see it for? Also, you know, we're going to make W's and Z's, and we did. And the W's and Z's were studied with great precision. No one doubts that this is there. If you look at the number of the experiment right now, because there's a cancellation between the W and Z to some extent, the 10/3 and the minus 5/3 over here, you could say the experiment's seeing the W but not the Z. That's the problem with it now, but I don't think any of us would interpret it that way. They're both there. In 1991, this group showed that the two-loop electroweak corrections were enhanced by log of mz squared over mu squared, which is a pretty big number. And because of the large number of diagrams, about 1,600, there's the potential for big enhancements. Fortunately, the enhanced ones is only around 32 diagrams, if I recall. Here's some examples. Some of them are very interesting. This is just an ordinary electromagnetic correction to the W that has such a logarithm in it. This is one from the Higgs that's 1,000 times bigger than the one-loop Higgs effect. At two loops, Higgs are generally bigger than at one loop. This is the main uncertainty, in fact, in this calculation, is we don't know the Higgs mass well enough. It's a small uncertainty, but it's the main uncertainty. Then there's what may be viewed as the most interesting piece, the anomaly, coming from all generations of quarks and leptons. And, you know, just the way we tell students, you have to have an anomaly cancellation, otherwise there are divergences in perturbation theory. These diagrams are divergent, and the divergences cancel between quarks and leptons. So it's a real effect. I asked Jakif why he didn't do that in 1972. He said he knew that they would cancel or something like that, but I'm suspicious. There's a finite piece left over because these aren't degenerate with one another. And in fact, the hadronic dependence of the up and down is a very interesting issue. The whole two-loop calculation was done a few years ago. The triangle was revisited here because of this question of what's left over. Our group differed from de Raphael's group on this. They call it an interesting disagreement. I don't like disagreements. They've now admitted that our result is correct on this. Numerically, it doesn't mean very much, but it's a point of principle in the following sense, that they were arguing that the up and the down contributions were modified by QCD in such a way that their short distance contribution was changed. Now, that's an anathema for QCD. That's not supposed to happen. And most people wouldn't take a strong view that that could happen. It probably points to problems in effective field theory, some effective field theory calculations that may have the same issue having to do with how you use the operator product expansion. Okay, the effects of two-loop are big. They reduce things by 22%. The leading three loops are essentially zero due to an interesting cancellation. And here's the electroweak. It's brought down from the 195. The hadronic is where all of the arguments have been. There's the two-loop hadronic vacuum polarization, and then these three-loop effects, with the light-by-light being the most difficult. This one you do, again, using the dispersion relation, with either E plus E minus goes to hadrons data, or tau decay data in the I equals 1 channel, which is rho-dominated, and that represents over 70% of this contribution. So the tau data is potentially very interesting here. You have to do an isospin rotation to go from one to the other. And there are isospin corrections due to the up-down mass difference and due to electromagnetism that you have to know how to account for in going from here to here. So the E plus E minus is certainly the better way to do it because you don't have to make as many corrections. But the tau data is statistically more powerful, and that's why the tau data was brought into the picture. In fact, in 1998, Davia and his collaborator Hooker did this calculation. They combined the two in order to reduce the error. The two were roughly consistent, although tau data always did give a somewhat larger value than E plus E minus data. And this is what they came up with, 69.24, with a rather small error because of the combination of the two. Now, what happened after that is Novosibirsk came up with new data that made the E plus E minus almost as good as the tau data. What emerged was a difference between the E plus E minus and the tau data, because the tau data was reanalyzed and went up, and the E plus E minus went down as a result of this. A real discrepancy ensued, and it was found that the E plus E minus data was normalized incorrectly. So the tau data played a very important role. I say it was a red flag telling us that there was something wrong. The normalization error has been corrected. The electron data is now over here with this kind of an error. The tau data, if used where it exists, can still reduce the error, but they're not consistent with one another. They differ by about 147 times 10 to the minus 11. So I believe, as do I think most people now, that the tau data is incomplete and therefore not to be used until someone overcomes this issue of have all of the isospin corrections been made properly. Okay. Now, other people have studied more recently E plus E minus, and they actually get a somewhat smaller number over here, going in the direction of the bigger discrepancy. The experiment doesn't compare against these. This one in particular, interestingly, gets the same value that Davier and Hooker had back in 1998 when the first comparison was made and the first 2.7 sigma deviation. So, in some sense, the central value, not much has happened in E plus E minus annihilation data. Where the action's been is in light by light. And in fact, in light by light, as everyone here knows, I'm sure, a sign mistake due to an I squared was uncovered in this class of diagrams. And minus 85 went to around plus 86. This was a major change, right? It's 200% error when you have a sign mistake. And it shifted things by about 170. So it looked like a shift that was going to make the experiment just never find a disagreement with the standard model. Now, a nice paper by Melnikov and Weinstein, using the operator product expansion, a little in the fashion that we used it in the electroweak corrections, to make sure that they had the right short distance behavior, at least come close to it, something the other calculations didn't have, has increased this number. I'm not sure the final word isn't exactly what this should be. I think their point is certainly well taken, that these diagrams should reproduce the short distance behavior here, and that should be a constraint on this, and that they do and no one else does. The number is likely to be bigger. There are a number of little corrections that if you try to sum up might bring this down a bit. So I don't know where it's going to wind up, but this is the kind of range, I think, that one could talk about. Okay, I'm not going to tell you about the history of light by light. It's a terrible history. But so here's how things stand. If we use Davier et al. From earlier this year, after all of the corrections D plus E minus were done, we have that 2.7 sigma deviation. If we take Hagivar et al., and I'm only using them because they're more recent and their paper is gigantic, it looks very like a lot of work went into it, the discrepancy becomes about 3.4 sigma, the error being a little bit smaller because they claim that they handle E plus E minus data better. If we take Melnikov and Weinstein at their central value, but they have a smaller uncertainty in the light by light, and we add them to Hagivara et al., the error gets somewhat smaller, the central value gets different, and we have about a 3 sigma deviation. If instead we say we're going to use Davier and Melnikov et al., then we have about a 2.2 sigma deviation. So, you know, you can take your pick right now. It's obvious that theory is not in bad, terrible shape, but there's still some work to be done to narrow this range down. The tau data reduction is big. However, the tau data deviation is coming from high Q squared. There's just a big disagreement between E plus E minus and tau data of the order of 10%, and when you get above the rho peak. Now, what's it due to? It may be due to the assumption that these are degenerate, and there may be a mass splitting, where the widths may be quite different from one another. I suspect it's this one over here. However, if that's the case and you don't have a first principles calculation of these differences, then you can't honestly make this correction. You can just fit the data and say, yes, the data suggests this is true, so I'm going to use that. But then you just can't use the tau data in any meaningful way. Okay, so there is new data from E plus E minus going to hadrons plus a hard gamma coming from Frascati that seems, they haven't given a quantitative number yet, but seems to support the E plus E minus data from Novosibirsk, particularly in the high energy region where this problem exists. Okay. Also, at SLAC, they can do the radiative return very well. So that's being done. SUSY implications. SUSY looks a lot like weak interaction physics. If you make the simplification that all of the masses are the same in the loop as a first approximation, you get roughly the same, like 150 versus 130, if the SUSY particles are 100 GeV. But there's an enhancement of tangent beta, which is a number between, let's say, 3 and 40 now in most SUSY models. And the sign can be plus or minus depending on the sign of the mu term in the Higgs sector. And so it looks like the sign of the mu should be positive if there's a deviation. And the mass scale for SUSY that would reproduce the deviation, depending on what tan beta you want, is between 94 and 540 GeV. This is the expected range of SUSY that people work in. You could almost call it a prediction that there should be a deviation in G minus 2. It was predicted by a number of people who did the early calculations of this, in fact. There are other new physics scenarios. For example, if you have a model where the muon's mass comes about from a loop effect, then there'll be a loop-induced G minus 2. It will be mu squared over the scale of the physics producing the mass, and then you probe something like 2 TeV. So in large extra dimension theories, this is a possible scenario, for example. Okay. Let me close on this with, I'm not good at making figures, but I took this old one. So here's the world average, here's the new BNL experiment. And fortunately, I can replace David Hall 98 by Hagi Varadol 2003 because their numbers are identical for this. So I could leave that one there. And you can see there's a real difference between these things, right? These are the two you should be comparing against this one. Now, if you use the Melnikov-Weinstein light by light, this will move up by about half of a sigma or so closer. But there's something it looks like really happening there. Now, in the future, like I said, here's what we could get to. I mentioned that at the beginning. I won't say it again. In the case of the tau data, I mean, people should be working on that, and I'm one of those people, and I'm sort of working on it with Davier, in fact, right now. We would like to see a lattice calculation. Tom Blum has done a preliminary lattice calculation with a quenched approach, et cetera. He really has to use dynamical fermions. But it looks very easy, in fact, easy by the standards of these things. I call it straightforward here. Basically, you have to know what is pi, the vacuum polarization at Q squared minus pi at zero. What's the difference? And this is dominated by low Q squared of order a third mu squared. If they can't calculate the change in pi from zero to a third mu squared with high precision, I don't think they can calculate anything with high precision, because this is very, very straightforward. Whether they can do light by light is another issue. That might be more difficult, but there they're only being asked to calculate it to 10 or 15%. Here they're being asked to calculate it to 1%. 1%'s hard. Okay, so I think it's doable that we'll get the error down by another factor of 2. Whether we get it down by another factor of 5 beyond that is we need some new technology. Now, it seems to me the big mistakes have been uncovered. Light by light's not going to change sign again, although it's changed 3 or 4 times. But and if it does, it makes the discrepancy bigger. But that mistake was uncovered. The only lingering thing is this tau data, because that's a big effect if it's really there. So you have to believe me when I say you should, at least for now, discount it. All right. if these goals are met experimentally in theory, we could easily get to a 5 sigma effect. Some of my colleagues say, well, what's the point? LHC will have already discovered supersymmetry. That's not a given that that will happen. But even if they do, you fold that into the calculation of G minus 2, and then you determine tan beta to 20%, which is probably the best determination of tan beta that we can do. So these things, you know, once they're done right, they last a long, long time and should be pursued. Now, E158, I'm probably running out of time. So I'll just, again, I said this at the beginning because I knew I'd run short of time. There are very interesting effects. The radiative corrections are 40%. The asymmetry in electron-electron fixed targets, around 10 to the minus 7, it's tiny. But the statistics are gigantic because it's a low Q-squared process. So it's more like measuring currents than individual electrons in this electron-electron scattering. And if you use a fixed target, the effective luminosity is bigger than 10 to the 38. So a fixed target always has this big advantage over a collider. They've measured this number, I mentioned at the beginning. The data taking is over. They're hoping to get it down further. If you ran this kind of an experiment at higher energies at the linear collider with fixed target, with a polarized electron beam, which it will have, you only need one polarized beam here, you could get sine squared theta w down well below any other experiment that exists. This was pointed out by Krishna Kumar, one of the members of the E158 team. And you only have to know the polarization to about 0.5%, which is the big advantage. To do giga z, you have to know it to better than 0.1%, and that's very, very difficult. Okay. The Higgs mass that you predict over here, again, is small. If we believe this number, it's in the 50 GeV range. If we believe this number from the BB bar, it's in the 500 GeV range. So it's certainly something that we should sort out. This just says the same thing. The W boson mass change, as I said, from 380.385, this is what's predicted usually in the standard model, about 39, at least for Higgs mass of 100. If it's any bigger than this, it suggests a lighter Higgs mass. And in fact, the old value suggested a Higgs mass of around 23. The new MW suggests something a little bit more acceptable, but still somewhat low. Together, they're suggesting the top is heavier. Okay, that's what I said before. And then everything's very consistent. So it's nice that we're going to improve these. It's important that we improve them. Now, this connection I mentioned at the beginning between M Higgs and the anomalous magnetic moment, they both depend on E plus E minus goes to hadrons data. G minus 2 is more sensitive, particularly in the low Q squared region. Usually when we do the fits for the Higgs, we use the hadronic contribution to this, we call delta alpha, and we use 0.2761. If you use the updates by Hagiwara et al., it goes down slightly to 2755, which allows a slightly larger Higgs mass. Okay, and so we're in better shape. This is a much more acceptable situation. If you use the tau data, and this is my rough estimate, people don't seem to want to touch this calculation, it goes up. And the already light Higgs goes down. So if you think E plus E minus to hadrons data is going to shift G minus 2 theory and experiment together, then you've got to confront the problem that will emerge in this other sector with it. So there's nice complementarity between G minus 2 and the other precision measurements. Although they appear very different at the beginning, they're connected through this hadronic vacuum polarization. Now this last thing, MW versus sine squared theta W, sine squared theta W bare is equal to E squared over G2, the SU2 coupling squared. It's a natural relation. That means both of these undergo infinite renormalization, and this one does, but the same infinities. And when you express them in terms of some measurable quantity, there'll be finite radiative corrections rather than infinite ones. Usually we use the Fermi constant, MW, alpha, and sine squared theta W from this relationship. Then we predict that there should be a non-zero radiative correction, which turns out to be about 7%, mainly because of this alpha over here and these kinds of hadronic vacuum polarizations. If you don't see exactly 7%, or 6.97%, whatever it actually is, then you're seeing new physics. The two candidates, most likely, I think, one, there's something wrong with the Fermi constant because muon decay is seen in excited W from large extra dimensions, for example, if things are right. This could be consistent, if that's all you do, with the fact that MW is coming out too large. It's telling you your Fermi constant that you're comparing the measured MW against the Fermi constant is a little bit off. The real MW mass is a little high, it looks like, because the Fermi constant is actually smaller because an extra dimension has slipped into it. It's a long shot, but the other possibility is the S parameter, usually associated with dynamical symmetry breaking, is causing a small shift in the W wave function renormalization that's present more in, it's different in muon decay than it is in the W mass determination. And if you solve for what S is, you find, as I gave at the beginning, S turns out from sine squared theta W and MW to be around minus 0.1 with rather small uncertainties. This is very hard for most of these types of theories to overcome, and that's why it's important to try to improve it. So let me conclude with my outlook on all this. In these really high precision measurements, there's no hint, as I can see, of new physics, except that the Higgs mass seems to be low, and it's been that way for a long time. Nevertheless, there are very powerful constraints on people who try to go beyond the standard model. Some people call it a prediction of supersymmetry, that they should all agree with one another because the loop effects are so small there. They do suggest that the top is somewhat heavier, and that seems to be the case. They do suggest that alpha 5 is not much bigger. Otherwise, the Higgs problem gets worse, if I can call it a problem. And so I think they really disfavor the tau data. Here's what the future will be, if everything's in control. I won't say anything about that. There's a difference in the anomalous magnetic moment that looks like it could be new physics. Like I said, we've seen the big corrections. There may be the tau lurking out there, but there's nothing else, I think, that anyone has suggested that can cause a big shift. And like I said, this one is very questionable right now, but should continue to be screened. The light by light, in fact, these observations of Melnikov and Weinstein, people should study them and try to see exactly what the central value should be. It looks like the goal of a 5 sigma effect is within reach. Now, if G minus 2 is seeing something, let's call it supersymmetry or anything else, and if it's seeing it at this level, then all dipole moments, electric dipole moments, if there's a phase in this thing, transition moments like this, they should start to see the effect of that new physics. Probably it violates flavor, etc. And you can ask at what level. And it's at an interesting level. For example, in the EDM of the muon, you can look for phases that go down to around 0.01 to see if there's a phase in this kind of a contribution. And mu goes to E gamma, or the mu E conversion, which measures roughly the same thing. The next generation of experiments will see an effect if there's flavor changing. If the loop particles, like this neutrinos, are exactly degenerate, they cancel and there's no flavor violation. If they don't, though, if they're not degenerate, you'll see an effect. If the mixing is large, you'll actually measure the neutrino mass splitting to one part per million, which is just not possible to do any other way. So if their mass is around 100 GeV, you'll measure them into the MeV region, okay, or 10 MeV region. And so I hope G minus 2 is again bringing good news, that happy days are upon us, that colliders are going to have a rich discovery, and that rare processes are going to be. But right now, I hope everyone goes out there and scrutinizes the tau data and the light-by-light calculation and really make sure that it's all on the up and up. Thank you.
So we have now room for some short questions.
So you said there's a 3.5 sigma discrepancy between, the leptonic and BB bar angles, and that's not really a hint of new physics, and yet the G minus 2 of the muon is a strong hint.
Well, I think that there is an answer to that. I think it's twofold. The usual answer from the lept people is, you know, that they measure 40 different things, and you expect something to deviate by 2 or 3 sigmas from the central value, which is you might view one of those two measurements as doing that. Well, both of them are deviating somewhat from it. G minus 2 is a single measurement. It's not bump hunting. It's not measuring 30 quantities and then getting a statistical fluctuation. One of them, it's one quantity that's been measured now about 3 times in the same experiment but under different running conditions. And it keeps showing this deviation. And so I think a 3 sigma deviation here is more meaningful than a 3-sigma deviation in a list of 30 different measurements. In addition, there are systematic questions. I think if you had to bet on one of those two sine squared measurements, you'd bet on the leptonic asymmetries as being correct. I mean, there's a field that goes into these. The left-right asymmetry at SLAC has very small radiative corrections in the QED sense that go into it. It looks like a very trustworthy measurement. Other issues in like B identification, et cetera, people have, I'm sure, have done a good job, as good as they can do, but there's always some remaining doubt one has when hadrons are involved and identification issues are coming in. So it's in that sense. The other issue, of course, is partly a psychological one, that G minus 2 is very sensitive to supersymmetry. Most people here work on supersymmetry, want to believe that it's there. It's like a prediction that there should be a deviation, and they see it. Z goes to BB bar, it's very hard to think of some new physics that will affect Z goes to BB bar and not Z goes into leptons, right? And so we're all naturally influenced by that, it seems to me. That's the way we operate. If you see a deviation, I think you should believe it as a theorist. Let the experimentalists worry about what's wrong with the experimental. It's part of it. And then you should, you know, go through all your creative juices to try to figure out what it could be. And if at the end you can't find any good explanation, you say, well, it's probably wrong, seems to me. That's the usual approach.
Any more questions?
You mentioned several times that there's a trivial thing for the lattice. Just to get 1%, something in within 1% on the lattice with dynamical fermions, I mean, the Kerr question could be trivial, but to get on that accuracy may not be trivial, right?
There are a number of things to be said. The first is that this is a really tailor-made calculation for the lattice, because what you do is, you know, the first thing you do when you do the loop calculation is you go to Euclidean space, you make a Wick rotation. That's how lattice people calculate this. Number two, lattice people don't have QED to bother them. Tau data and the E plus E minus data, you've got to subtract out QED. So they're really calculating the right thing. Now, so that sounds good. Those are the good sides. Now comes 1%. They advertise that in the future they'll do 1% charm measurements, et cetera, right? So they advertise 1%. This is asking them, can they produce 1%? Now, 1%, the things you mentioned, do come about. How do they normalize their lattice spacing at 1%? Well, they probably have to use the rho mass, calculate the rho mass to 1%, and then they're going to have to figure out what's the rho mass from this data over here, which is going to be an issue. And there'll be QED effects. When the QED effects will come back to haunt them, because 1% QED is there. And they're going to have to figure out how to normalize everything to 1%. That's an interesting confrontation they've never had to address before. So it's very interesting for them. But in terms of the type of calculation, it's very straightforward. That's why I said if they can't do this to 1%, don't believe anything to 1%. Maybe they can't do this to 1%, but then I think my other statement applies. I don't know, because you know, as they continue to study the data, they're reducing the systematics. I mean, the experiment was advertised to have systematics more than a factor of 2 or 3 below what I showed over here. And I think they may be a little worse than they anticipated, but not significantly worse.
I just wanted to know if you had any insight on what the future plans of the G-2 experiment at Brookhaven are.
Well,
what the schedule is.
They want to run more. You know, the data was last taken in 2001. They're going to go to Washington. I don't know who you see in Washington. Marburger, when he was our director, made the statement that G-2 is the most beautiful experiment he had ever seen, and it was his favorite experiment. We'll see if he forgot that. I don't know what kind of impact he has in Washington anyway. Now, the two stories I heard, they went down last year before this result was given to the DOE to ask for money to do more running. And the two statements that got back to me was, one was the positive view and one was the negative. The negative one was they were told, don't come down here again until you've shown your result from U-. And the positive one was, we're looking forward to your visit after you've shown your result from U-. And that spin will tell you, depending on who said it, what their view is, the chances. It's not a lot of money. It's an issue with the DOE whether they want to continue to fund this kind of an experiment, it seems to me. I would say it's 50-50, the chances, because they can either say yes or no. So.
So let's thank the audience.